Tonight on Arena, 50 years on from its first airing, we celebrate the Mary Tyler Moore Show and new albums from Fiona Apple, Columbia Mills and Ron Sexsmith. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Joy Crooks is a singer from London. Her father is from Dublin. Her mother is from Bangladesh. Joy's music has been gathering acclaim since her first EP release in 2018. And later this year, she's promising us to give us her debut album. She was due to make her Three Arena Dublin debut next month, but obviously that gig has had to be rescheduled. But I'm delighted to say Joy has taken some time to join us on Arena tonight from her home in London, and I'll be speaking to her shortly. But first, let's go back to that debut EP. Five-song release entitled Influence, and here from Influence is a song called Mother, May I Sleep with Danger.
Mother, may I sleep with danger, please? It's been knocking on my door since I was 17. Oh, when you saw but you chose to ignore. But now it's more than a wish, it's a dream. Now I don't understand how you can hold me back. You said, baby, learn your lesson.
And that's a song called Mother, May I Sleep with Danger from Joy Crooks and her debut EP, Influence. And Joy Crooks joins me now on the line from her home in London. I thought when I saw the title and heard the ideas behind that song initially, Joy, that it might be something to do with you heading off into the dangerous world of music. Was it about that? Was it about something else?
No, it wasn't. I was dating a fella and his mom really didn't like me, and it kind of felt like, when I first met her, it felt like he'd gone and asked her, Mother, may I sleep with danger? As if I was the danger.
So you were the... It wasn't you speaking to your mother, somebody else speaking to his mother, which is often a sign that it may be time to let go and go somewhere else.
Well, you say that, but I was talking to my mum in the second verse because I realised that I could relate to the question just as much.
Right, fair enough. A lovely little kind of jazz sound in there that I can hear. There's soul, R&B and pop. But yet, I think when you started out, and particularly some of your early YouTube outings, Joy, feature you and your guitar singing tributes to the likes of Dylan and the Pogues. Where did your musical journey begin?
I think it began in the ambulance that my mum was in when she was going to have me. They named me after an Isaac Hayes song, so I was pretty much cursed from the beginning.
Music was a big deal at home, was it?
I guess so. I mean, none of my family are musicians. My grandma sings in a parish in Dublin, but that's it. So everyone adores music, but no one is actually has ever done it the way I make music in my family.
And you say your grandma sings in a parish in Dublin. Do you have much connection? Obviously, you have no connection to her, unfortunately, at the moment. You can't have much other than FaceTime and Zoom and the likes. But in the general course of events, would you spend time here in Dublin? Because your father's from Dublin.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in Dublin, actually. I spent a lot of, you know, it's not far from London, so I spent a lot of my summers there, Easters. Even now, I still try and go there 2 to 3 times a year. So I'm very, very close to Ireland.
And how's your nan getting on in the current situation? Have you spoken to her recently?
Honestly, she's not doing very well. She's actually in a hospital in Blanchardstown. And because she's in isolation, I haven't been able to speak to her.
Oh, dear.
So, it's not the best, but I'm sure she'd be happy to know that I spoke about her on your show.
Well, I hope that somehow she will get hold of the fact that she was mentioned on radio this evening and that you and I'm sure the whole family are thinking of her, and we send our best regards. Yeah, and kindest wishes to her as well. Hopefully she will come out the other side of these awful things that are happening to people at the moment. You do spend time in Dublin. Do you think the Dublin side of things has influenced the musical choices you've made and the music that you make, Joy?
I think it's definitely... I think the nature of storytelling is a very Irish tradition. And I think that I didn't necessarily have to grow up in Ireland to inherit that. I think having the father that I did and having the the upbringing that I did, and his love for poetry, music, art, culture was really, really integral in me learning how to storytell and how to write songs. And I think that, you know, that's kind of proven by the likes of Shane McGowan. He was very much a storyteller, and he is very much a storyteller.
Yeah, and even in the way you describe the song that we heard a bit of at the beginning of this, Mother May I Sleep With Danger, verse one, we get one part of the story. Verse two, we get another part of the story. And as it goes on, of course, yeah. we see several points of view. And what about the Bangladeshi side of things then? Your mother's from Bangladesh. Do you, I suppose that's a more difficult trip to make on a more regular basis, or a, as regular a basis as you would get to Dublin?
It is. I haven't been to Bangladesh as many times as I've been to Ireland, but... I think the thing with Bangladesh is we have a huge Bangladeshi community in London, as well as the Irish community. And you inherit so much of the culture, again, growing up in a Bangladeshi household, regardless of whether it's in London or Bangladesh, it's still very much influenced by Bangladesh. So it's not hard to escape my cultures, put it that way. Hmm.
I can imagine. And of course, London and the United Kingdom, London in particular, I suppose, is such a conglomeration and collection of different cultures. You know, you're not unusual in any respect in that regard to have parents from different cultures. You must feel like many other people.
Yes, for sure. I mean, it makes your identity a little bit more tangible and understandable when you grow up in a melting pot like London. You know, it's not unusual to be... I mean, it is unusual to be Bangladeshi Irish, because I haven't actually met a Bangladeshi Irish person before, but it isn't unusual to be a mix when you're from London at all.
On your second EP, an EP that was called Perception, released last year, in fact, I think, you have a song called London Mine. What was in your mind with that song, Joy?
When I wrote that song, the Windrush scandal had just surfaced the news. It had been going on for quite some time, but the government here was sending off people who they didn't seem, or didn't, people from Jamaica who they didn't deem as British, even though they'd been in this country for their whole lives and were so integral to our community and our society and building this city. And it cut very, very deep for me, because I think with the likes of Brexit and the political tension here in the UK, immigrants and the work and the love and the affection and the importance of immigrants has been overlooked. And I wanted to write a love song to those immigrants, but I wanted to set the scene in London and show that without these people, we wouldn't have been able to make London.
Well, let's have a listen to a little bit of that song then, Joy Crooks, and from her second EP, Perception, a song called London Mine.
But that's what makes London mine.
And that's London Mine from Joy Crooks from her second EP, Perception. And originally, Joy is speaking to me from London this evening. Originally, Joy, we had hoped that you'd be in studio with us this evening, as you'd be getting ready to do your ahead of your Three Arena Dublin debut. That must have been a huge disappointment when that is cancelled. I know it's going to happen, or the hope is it will happen next March, March the 19th, 2021. Very difficult times for singers at this point, I would think.
Yes, I mean, I have the fantastic father of mine that is a huge hypochondriac. So I kind of had in my head from the very beginning of this year to be wary and to be to not expect too much, because I was quite concerned about the epidemic in China. And so I put it this way: I didn't have my hopes too high, But I definitely was disappointed. But in the back of my mind, I kind of, you know, this is for the better. This is for everyone's well-being. And I think that in order to move forward and to be sensible about this situation, I couldn't think about the should've, could've, would've. I had to kind of go with the flow, you know?
And that song, London Mine, I know there's the edge of the critique that you had in there, particularly around the whole Windrush scandal of last year, really, wasn't it, towards the end of last year that it broke. But there is a sense of a love letter to London in there. People are speaking here about how there's more of a sense of community now, ironically, in many ways, even though we're physically apart. Do you get the same sense in London?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every Thursday we get out on our balconies or outside our windows and we clap for the NHS. I think that, you know, the most fundamental parts of this country, and such as the NHS and these key workers and the people that are still going out during this very scary time and dedicating their lives to their jobs are being highlighted. And I think that that is starting to show people who didn't recognise them before, how important these people really are to the city and to the country. So there's definitely a huge sense of unity, 100%.
Yeah, it's very similar to what we're experiencing here, I think. Anyone But Me is the song that I want to finish up with. But as we head into it, Joy, maybe I could ask you about, because it was really noticeable, in fact, in London Mine, really relaxed vocal style that you have, both as a speaker and as a singer. Are you one of these people who's swan on the outside but the legs are paddling madly underneath, or are you just incredibly relaxed?
I'm a paddler for sure. I'm a paddler. I'm always paddling.
So you're telling me that even as you're singing songs like London Mine, or as you're speaking to me, that the tummy flutters are clicking away all the time?
Oh my goodness, when I wrote London Mine, I was self-doubt central. I just didn't think a song was going to come out of that day. I didn't see any hope. Ironically, that's where the lyric hopeless came from, because I was actually feeling hopeless myself.
Well, there you go. You proved yourself wrong. Give me a line into Anyone But Me, the current single, Joy, if you would.
Anyone But Me is probably one of my most personal and honest songs, and I think it's really applicable to the times that we're in now. And it's a story about my experience with my mental health, and I think that a lot of people could relate to this or need to hear this right now. So
well,
enjoy
Joy,
it.
Great to speak with you this evening. Hopefully we will get to see you before March the 19th, 2021. And let's finish up by listening to the song that Joy has just introduced to us, Anyone But Me.
Inside my head, a voice that controls me. I'd rather be somewhere else with anyone but me.
You're listening to Friday Night's Arena.
Suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it. Love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have the town, why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all.
Ah, yes, makes you feel all cosy. 50 years ago, Mary Richards started a new life for herself when she got a job as an associate producer in the newsroom of WJM-TV in Minneapolis. This storyline was the premise for The Mary Tyler Moore Show, First broadcast September 19th, 1970. One of the most successful sitcoms of its time, perhaps all time. It would certainly go on to influence other sitcoms that you have come to know and love. Cheers, Seinfeld, and a whole bunch of others as well, I'm sure, that Donald Clark will claim as the children of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He's a huge fan of Mary Tyler Moore and the show, and he joins me now. Mary Tyler Moore herself, because Mary Richard was called Mary, and because Mary Tyler Moore is called Mary, I always think of the two of them as exactly the same person. So let's be clear. Well, let's talk about Mary Tyler Moore first of all. Clearly enough, she was a star in her own right in 1970. To get your own show with your name over the door, as it were, hugely impressive. Just how big a star was she, Donald?
Well, she was quite a big star, I mean, but probably still mainly through television. She did a lot of work in commercials and smaller roles in the early 1960s, but what really made her a name was playing Dick Van Dyke's wife in the Dick Van Dyke Show. There was a whole vogue at that stage of having actors and comedians play characters but have the still name the show after the actor. After that, which ended in 1960, she was in a hit movie called Thoroughly Modern Millie with Julie Andrews. Not very well regarded now, but it made money. And played a nun opposite Elvis Presley in Change of Habit. But she was still mainly known for the role the Dick Van Dyke Show, which caused some complications when they went to work out the scenario for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. It is a rare example. I mean, before going on to talk about the sociological importance of it, it's worth saying that this all makes it sound very dry. It's an incredibly funny show, thing to say first up. It works as a comedy, but as it happened, it also was important sociologically. It was quite a rare example in those days of a contemporaneous TV show that was based around a genuinely single woman, that is to say, not dependent on any man. But they still were kind of constrained by certain conventions and mores of the day. She was supposed to initially be divorced, but they thought that would be a little too unpalatable for the audience then, not least because audiences might think that Mary Tyler Moore was still the character she played in Dick Van Dyke's Show and that she divorced Dick Van Dyke. There was also kind of strange little prejudices lurking around. The research department at CBS said that American audiences wouldn't tolerate divorce in a series lead any more than they would tolerate Jews, people with moustaches, or people who live in New York, which demonstrates the kind of things they were up against in those days. So they had her as a woman moving to Minneapolis after a bad relationship had fallen through. It had to work within those conventions of the day. It's interesting that not every feminist of the era was fully behind it. Gloria Steinem pointed out, for example, that she was the only person in the office who referred to Lou Grant, played by the great Ed Asner, as Mr. Grant. Everybody else, all the males, still called her Lou. But you can feel throughout the 7 years that the show ran, the patriarchy creaking a little as the show worked its way along. She discovered in series three that the man who previously held her job as producer had a higher salary, so she had to fight for that. As always, worked good comedy in that. Out of that, there's a total exasperation from the men in the office because he earned more because he was a man. That itself seems to be an explanation no further is required. I was watching an episode last week, and there's an interesting dig at the Brady Bunch in the middle of all this, where one of the characters discusses a sitcom called The Clancy Clan, in which, as they say, there's a show about a family with all these kids, and everyone laughs a lot because they have all these kids, and that's the only joke. They knew they were onto something, I think, at this stage. And a lot of people felt at the time, Michelle Obama is somebody who'd be about my sort of age, looked at it and she said, look, she wasn't married, she wasn't looking to get married, and that inspired her to think that, you know, as a young woman, that she too could move forward without feeling that the main justification for living a good life was securing a man.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a clip where she's in the job interview, very first episode, in fact, I think, of the series, of season one of the series. And in their first meeting, Ed Asner, as Lou Grant, shows Mary his inappropriate job interview techniques.
What religion are you?
Mr. Grant, I don't quite know how to say this, but you're not allowed to ask that when someone's applying for a job. It's against the law.
Want to call a cop?
No.
Would you think I was violating your civil rights if I asked if you're married?
Presbyterian.
There you go, religion and marital status in an interview. But I want to continue before I come back to you, Donald, with another clip from that same interview. And Lou Grant, again, pay comes up as an issue here. An unusual job offer to Mary Richards.
Yes, Mr. Grant, I will, but it does seem that you've been asking a lot of very personal questions that don't have a thing to do with my qualifications for this job.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well, yes.
I hate spunk. Tell you what. I'll try you out for a couple of weeks, see if it works out.
Oh.
If I don't like you, I'll fire you.
Right, right.
You don't like me? I'll fire you.
Yes, yes. That certainly seems fair. What's the job?
The job is that of associate producer.
Associate?
Something wrong?
No, I like it. Associate producer.
The job pays $10 less a week than the secretarial job.
That'll be fine.
If you can get by on 15 less a week, we'll make you a producer.
No, I think all I can afford is associate producer.
There you go. I wish you could hear what my producer's saying in my ear as she listens to that particular clip. Donald Clark speaking to us this evening about Mary Tyler Moore, 50 years old at the show this year. And there we heard Mary Tyler Moore as Mary Richards, Lou Grant, or Ed Asner rather, as Lou Grant in that scene from that wonderful job interview. But it brings up exactly the points that you were touching on, Donald, that there it is. It's hilariously funny, but boy, is it making some actually, you know, really serious and pertinent sociological and political points.
It is. And I think it's worth saying as well that, I mean, they put their money where their mouth is, that they actually employed women writers on Mary Tyler Moore, which is something that is still not happening in a lot of American comedy to this day. By 1973, 25 out of the 75 writers who'd been there were women, which was, you know, it's a third, it's below half. But I mean, it's much higher than you often encounter 30 or 40 years later. Mindy Kaling based Late Night, that film she made recently, on her experiences being one of the few women writers in the writer's room for the American office. And it also, I mean, it's the lightness of which it treated serious issues was most impressive. There was one episode in which Mary became addicted to sleeping pills, which is very much an issue of the time. There was an episode where, right in the middle of the whole Watergate business, she went to jail because she wouldn't reveal a source to the authorities, and that makes it sound very pious. But in fact, all those issues were addressed incredibly with incredibly light touch. So the comedy never lessened, even when you're touching on those things. And I think the other thing that was interesting about the sexual politics of how it worked out was that I think it was important that the glamorous lead, in inverted commas, and also the good girl, I put those words again in deep inverted commas, was herself allowed to be funny, and allowed to be, rather than being the straight woman to funny men or wacky woman. You look back at, you know, the previous decade, Lucille Ball, for example, was very attractive, but she was always the goofball. Hollywood movies had no problem with a funny female lead, Jean Harlow, Jean Arthur, Carol Lombard, that whole set. But TV was a more conservative medium. That you, that's, to that stage, the sensible good girl was supposed to look at the men and roll her eyes, not actually be funny. In this sense, I mean, she was the most sane of the bunch around her, but she wasn't. She was never a boring nag. I mean, just something. Yeah. She was something in a similar position to Jerry Seinfeld was in Seinfeld. She's the most sane person, but that doesn't stop her being funny. And also those characters around her, it's worth reminding us, were so well written that the show managed to generate three successful spin-offs, which is most unusual. Rosa, famously, with Valerie Harper. Valerie Harper, who died just last year, was as big a hit as Mary was. Rosa, her best friend, lived upstairs and moved to New York City. There was a series with Cloris Leachman called Phyllis, about Phyllis, her other neighbour, her snobby neighbour, which wasn't quite so successful. And then there was Lou Grant, which is a fascinating series because it is one of the very few series I can think of, if I can't think of any, in fact, which was a straight drama that spun off from a comedy. And the fact that you could do that, I think, demonstrated how good the actors were and how carefully they'd thought about the characters. They had sufficient depth and sufficient resonance that they could extend into further series, and even into further series in a different genre.
And the fact that you were talking about creator James L. Brooks here, now we can associate James L. Brooks with The Simpsons, as good as it gets, Terms of Endearment, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But at the point of Mary Tyler Moore, how established was he at that point in creating series?
Oh, he was a young
like
man,
this?
He was barely 30. I mean, this was the first big break, and he went on to develop a whole series of sitcoms before he became, you know, the voice of the millennium, the voice of the millennial generation with The Simpsons in the 1990s. And one of the things he did, which again gets back to the influence of the television shows, one of his best films, I think, that he made when he went into movies was Broadcast News. And Broadcast News is a shameless remake of the Mary Tyler Moore show. Holly Hunter is the Mary character. William Hurt is Ted, the dumb newsreader. Albert Brooks is Murray, the kind of the smart writer who sits in the background and basically makes everything happen. And that it wasn't the only almost straight remake of it. Tina Fey is perfectly happy to admit and acknowledge that 30 Rock is essentially a variation of the Mary Tyler Moore show. In that case, Tina Fey is Mary, Alec Baldwin is Lou Grant, Tracy Morgan is Ted. It had that specific influence, and also it had a more general influence as well, in that the school of grown-up situation comedy that came after that, you know, gave us Cheers in the 1980s, Seinfeld, which just mentioned, 1990s, and I think all those sprang, all those were able to happen because at this stage, in the early 1970s, someone had the guts to create a show that was constructed around adult characters and adult situations.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it has such an effect. I'm even thinking of the fact that, you know, seven seasons, the First Lady at the time, a Republican First Lady, Betty Ford, appeared in one of the episodes. Now, you can't imagine that happening today. But if you look at it now in 2020, 50 years later, is it still funny? I mean, it sounds from the clips to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a funny experience with it in the time. I mean, I would have, looking back actually when I was doing a bit of research the last day or so, I was aware intermittently it was screened on British and Irish television. I was in a bit of it when I was a kid in Belfast, and then on RTE, which showed it in the mid-1970s. And then, you know, because we didn't, you know, it wasn't so easy to access old television in those times. And quite often what happened is shows went away, you didn't see them for 20 years. And I didn't see it for 20 years until RTE began screening at lunchtime in the mid-1990s. I know of at least one journalist who's younger than me, a contributor to this show, who watched it when she was at college for the first time. I thought, what's this terrific show? And I went back to it with a different attitude. I sort of thought, this is something I remember from my childhood. I bet it's dated. I bet it looks really cheesy, as all kinds of shows, alas, did when you go back to them after that vintage. And it didn't. It works like an absolute dream. I mean, you notice that there are certain things which are just done differently. The scenes are longer is one thing which really strikes you. We're now used to kind of shorter, punchier scenes, and even the best sitcoms. I don't mean that as criticism of the current situation, the current aesthetic situation comedy. But the comedy still is absolutely, completely fresh as it was then. And yes, you're quite right to point out that you come across surprising things throughout it. Betty Ford turning up in a very funny scene where she phones up and basically Lou knows Betty Ford. No one else believes it's actually her when she phones up, which couldn't have happened either side. And one other thing to point out to demonstrate the resilience of it as a feature in US culture is we played the excellent theme song at the start, which is also one of the great theme songs. And there's a whole three generations of people who still, whenever they think of Mary Tyler Moore, think of that last image of her, which is throwing her hat in the air.
All right, well, that's what we...
As a gesture of kind of celebration of having escaped something and looking forward to a new life. So much was that, so resonant was that, there's a statue of it now in Minneapolis, which people go and visit and touch as if it were a holy relic.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll be throwing our hats in the air soon outside our houses towards our neighbours in a different type of celebration. In the meantime, we'll have to do with thinking of that particular celebration from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Donald Clark speaking to us about it this evening. You can find the Mary Tyler Moore Show on Prime or on Hulu. It's also available all of the seasons on DVD. Well worth a look, I would have thought. And so to that part of Friday evening that is our album reviews. Three up for you this evening as usual. 8 years on from her last LP, Fiona Apple gives us Fetch the Bolt Cutters. CCTV comes from Irish band Columbia Mills. And Ron Sexsmith brings us his 17th studio album, which is called Hermitage. Kate Brennan Harding, Brian Boyd have been listening to all three and they join me now. We're going to start with Fiona Apple's Fetch the Bolt Cutters. Suffice to say at this point that our reviewers could not have more differing views. Let's have a listen for ourselves and then hear their opinions afterwards. This is a track called For Her.
You tie everything up ready in the second act. When you know that it didn't go exactly like that, you arrive and drive by like a soft stuff bat. Like you know you should know, but you don't know where it's at. Like you know you should know, but you don't know where it's at. Like you know you should know, but you don't know where it's at. You arrive and drive by like a soft stuff bat. Like you know you should know, but you don't know where it's at. You arrive and drive by like a soft stuff bat. Like you know you should know, but you don't know where it's at. Like you know you should know, but you don't know what you did.
And that is a song called For Her from Fiona Apple's new album, Fetch the Bolt Cutters. Brian Boyd and Kate Brennan Harding. I can't wait to hear this. You've been waiting 8 years with bated breath for this album to come along. How excited have you been, Kate? And how do you feel now that you've heard the album?
I'm really, really glad to have heard the album. I'm really glad it's released. I actually think for me, I loved Tidal and I've kind of gone with her on a journey over her career, but definitely Fetch the Bolt Cutters for me up there. I absolutely love it. And I love that track For Her that you've just played.
Tidal was the debut album from 1996. Brian Boyd, I wondered as that track started, the little sigh that Fiona Apple made, I wondered were you sighing even as the track started?
I was. I didn't get this at all, Sean. An emotional revelation is Fiona Apple's calling card. She has this, she deals with very intense topics such as sexual abuse and mental health issues in her songs. So she's built up this very sort of intense relationship with her fan base, and her songs do tend to have a very binary quality to them. Either you're there with her on a very profound level or it all just goes straight over your head. Mm. This album went straight over my head. I found very, very little redeeming qualities in it. It's very percussive based. To me, it sounded like an Adam and the Ants record. She wails a lot. I imagined almost it was like Yoko Ono wailing over an Adam and the Ants track. It's supposed to be sort of beat poetry. It did not sound like beat poetry to me. It sounded like the neurotic ramblings of someone living in a Los Angeles gated community.
Wow.
Oh, dear. Well, Kate, come back.
That's funny. I suppose it is polarizing, and I get that. I think when women are in their early 40s and come into their power hugely, that can be confronting for people. I think that this album is her in standing in her power rather than questioning anything she ever did before. I think the lyrics that she has chosen and how she is taking a look back actually at stuff that happened to her in her life, but not from her younger self. She's looking at it from, she's somebody who about a year and a half, 2 years ago gave up alcohol. She sort of, you wouldn't say she became reclusive, but she definitely has been sort of just staying in her house on Venice Beach and recording this album there over the last 8 years. But all of this, I just feel that this is a woman who has taken the grit and taken what has been thrown at her, looked at it and now stands complete. This is who I am and I am comfortable in my voice. That's what when I hear the album.
Okay, but before we get the stars from both of you, Brian, first of all, you do say that she has a good voice. So if she has the voice and you recognise some of the musical talent there, I think, as well. What's not working and then stars?
Absolutely. There's a great voice there, Sean. It's very expressive and she has something to say. I just feel that the stream of consciousness lyrics just ended up in a lyrical cul-de-sac and they just spluttered out. There's a very unappealing kookiness to her character which actually irritated me. A good producer would have sorted this out. Stars, zero. Sorry. There you go.
Zero. Kiss.
I think her kookiness, I think men are allowed to be kooky and I think women sometimes aren't allowed to be kooky. Fetch the Bolt Cutters, for me, got 5 out of 5.
Fetch the Bolt Cutters, which incidentally is a quote from the TV series The Fall. Let us move on then to our second album this evening, Columbia Mills. And the album is called CCTV. The opening track has those initials within it, but they don't. CCTV doesn't stand for quite what you think it might stand for. I don't want to say the name of the track, so I hope that I've given enough of a hint as to what exactly it is, because it's spoken quite early into this opening track.
And if the cards you held against your chest would somehow be revealed, and if you wonder where I've been, I needed to be revived while they showered you in water and watched you.
There we go. CCTV, the title of the album. Car Crash TV, the title of the opening track, which was a little surprise for me. Was it a surprise for you, Brian Boyd, as you started out the opening track of this album? Were you getting what you expected from Columbia Mills?
No, and I'm glad I didn't, Sean. The more I hear of them, the more impressed I am. They're an Irish five-piece who are loosely would be on the intersection somewhere of indie-tronica and pop music. They've had their first album was released a few years ago, and they constantly between there's been one album, there's been two EPs, there's this new album. They constantly change their sound, and I think they've really found they're in a really interesting place now. There was times in this album where I was brought back to the Hansa studio in Berlin in 1970s, where Bowie famously recorded the Low, Heroes and Lodger trilogy of albums. There's a beautiful iciness to the music, and then there's other times where you're reminded of The Cure in the 1980s, that sort of indie guitar rock. They've found a really, really good place. And what most impressed me is with the vocals, and we heard it there on that track you just played, that they're allowing the vocals to breathe, and they're not, a lot of electronica bands, loosely speaking, can tend to throw the kitchen sink at a track, and there's lots of space on this, and the vocal is very affecting. I found the...
Oh, I think Brian has dropped out briefly there. So let me actually hand it over to you at that point, Kate. Clearly, we're going to, I think, have a little bit more concord in your reviews of CCTV.
Completely.
From Columbia Mills. But you should admit, first of all, I noticed that you called the band by first names. So you are pals.
I do.
Critical Head still has to be in play, please.
Well, you'll see, because I sent you the review there, and I did have to take a step back because I've been a big fan of the band for a number of years. And I was hoping that I would hear exactly what I've heard. And I love how they've expanded their use of electronic sound. The first track that you heard there, Car Crash TV, it's a pity it didn't go in. Once it kicks into 3 minutes, that track actually changes shape completely, which I think gives you a reflection of where the band have gone to in this album. I love the album, and I think that there's a song on it called Isolate, which they wrote over a year ago, and it's nothing to do with isolation now. They're kind of keen to stress, but it actually has Giorgio Moroder, Donna Summer vibes to it, and that's the way to my heart anyway. I think as well they touch on very, very strong topics. They talk about losing friends to depression. It's a very powerful album lyrically as well, and I think that blends really nicely with the way they fit in their new electronic sound.
Yeah, Brian, you're back with us now, I believe. What Kate is saying there, I think, is part of what you were referring to, this idea that they can let the vocals and the lyrics, they can give them enough space that we hear them, as they do in the opening section of that Car Crash TV track. But they're not afraid then to do the, you know, push you out onto the floor for a dance later on when some of the electronica stuff kicks in.
Yes, and what Kate was saying there, that you don't know where the songs are going, that's the great thing. I mean, often, we're here with you, Sean, and we're talking about songs where we actually know, we can say, you know, verse, bridge, chorus, verse. What I really liked about this is there was a constant surprise with all the with every song I heard in this. There's a track called Heart and Soul, which is just beautiful. And also I like the fact that the very final song, Mirror in the Front Seat, showed a completely different side to them than the rest of the album. And it sort of gave some pointers as where they're going sound-wise on the next album. And you do get, there's a real sense of confidence you get off this band, that you sense that this, they have more, they have another gear to get to, which they will get to on the next album.
All right. Completely. Happier This Time. Stars, Brian?
4.
And Kate?
I'm 5 out of 5. I absolutely love it.
You absolutely love it. 5 out of 5. So there we go. We're happy at home again with the two of you in Concord. Not sure what way we're going to go on our final album. It comes from the Canadian singer-songwriter Ron Sexsmith's 17th album called Hermitage. And as that title suggests, we're in a place of tranquility, which coincides with Sexsmith's recent personal move from Toronto to the rural town of Stratford, Ontario. Let me just check as I'm saying this. Yes, let us listen to the opening track here, Spring of the Following Year.
Will there be flowers to shower our hearts, vines that climb around our door, and will you love me even more, for love is our city on the hill, don't it seem pretty from a window sill?
Ah, there you go. Now we're all in a happy place, Spring of the Following Year. And in fact, Kate Brennan-Harding, that opening song, you said, really gave you a sense of hope. And Sexsmith himself referred to this, that maybe this is the sort of song we need to be listening to right now.
Yeah, like he also, like Columbia Mills before, he also considered whether he would release this album then or now or after, you know, we've all been out of isolation. So he said it was perfect upbeat record because you can just get kind of lost in it. And I can just see him moving, and he talks about wandering around his new home, and you can hear that. And it's just a really sweet album.
Yeah, and the bird song at the top, Brian. Perfect and upbeat. Well, upbeat at any rate. Not necessarily or usually something that we'd associate with Ron Sexsmith.
Mm. No, as you were saying, Sean, it's the 17th album. And previously he would have been known as dealing really, he was gloomy. He was very melancholic in his subject matter, in his songs. And he was seen as sort of a Canadian Elvis Costello, quite surly and quite sardonic. And this really is a revelation in that it really is location, location, location. He moved from an apartment in a busy Toronto street into rural Ontario, and it's done him the world of good. It really reminded me of, if you remember when the Beatles broke up and Paul McCartney went up to live on a Scottish farm and recorded these beautiful, the early McCartney solo albums are now regarded as some of his finest ever work. And very coincidentally, McCartney played all the instruments on the album, on those albums himself, and Ron Sexsmith plays all the instruments in these albums. So there is that sort of that rural idyll, bucolic sort of sound to it. And it's just a sheer coincidence that these songs were which are very upbeat, and they're very much about there's a song called Spring of the Following Year, which more or less says, look, everything's going to be okay. These songs were recorded before this present madness we're living in, but it's just a very, very happy coincidence that we've got an album which will sound fantastic coming out of our radio stations over the next few weeks.
And in fact, you both pointed out regarding the Beatles and Paul McCartney, particularly on the track Small Minded World, you can really hear the Beatles influence there. And Sexsmith himself says, that's what I'm doing. I need to wrap up because we're coming up towards 8 o'clock. I'll go to you first, Kate. Give me your summary and stars for Ron Sexsmith.
My summary is, this is perfect to go for a walk in. Definitely get to track 10, whatever shape your heart is in. It's gorgeous. And I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5.
All right. And finally from you, Brian.
This is a sit out in the garden on a summer's evening album, Sean. Four stars from me.
All right. That's if you're lucky enough to have the garden to sit out in, but maybe imaginatively you can go there with the help of Ron Sexsmith and his album Hermitage. Before that, we were speaking about Columbia Mills and CCTV. And the very first album that we spoke about was Fiona Apple and Fetch the Bolt Cutters, Brian Boyd and Kate Brennan-Harding. That's our lot for this evening, indeed, for this week here on Arena. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Dave Gibson was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you on Monday at 7. Have a great weekend. Look after each other, look after yourself, and we'll all be safe together.